Welcome to those of you who are new to this final of today's Northeast final, regional final of the Institute of Ideas and Prize in Debating Matters competition. And we end with a very important motion, important to society, obviously important to me today. Scientists should adopt the precautionary principle, is what we're discussing. All of you have prepared for this motion. All of the schools obviously hope that you get here, and I know unfortunately some of you aren't here yet. But it's such an important motion that we would encourage you all to join in the discussion and the debate, and it's your opportunity now not just to try and get the individual prize, obviously that's good to do, but actually to really try and put your peers up here under a bit of pressure and to really try and think through the arguments. We have, as our final teams, we have Wrighton Comprehensive School and we have Queen Elizabeth Sixth Form College. Can we just welcome them and congratulate them for being here? I'm going to introduce now a range of judges. First of all, our individual judges, who I want them to wave as I read their name out. They're the ones who are looking for the best individuals. So we've got Alex Akuli, who's there, who presently works at the Institute of Ideas. He's on his way to postgrad study in political theory. He writes for the online current affairs magazine Spiked. He reviews for Culture Wars. He's a regular on the online TV channel 18 Downing Street, and he's a recent graduate of international relations and history at LSE, which shows you, you know, just when you graduate, you can then start your great burgeoning media career, which is what Alex has done. We then have Danielle Priestley. There you are, down there. Danielle is a first year in international relations at the London School of Economics. She's already president of her halls, and she's been invaluable at helping out doing the press work for debating matters. We then have Elaine Hall, who's there. Elaine is a senior researcher for the Centre of Learning and Teaching at Newcastle University. She's worked here for 10 years on a range of projects, everything from the development of speech in young children to the motivation of adult learners. And one of the things she says she's valuably learned is the importance of being able to construct a well-supported argument. So that's obviously what she's going to be looking out for. We then have Simon Watts. Simon, rather unusually, is a Viking. He's a Viking and a tour guide, and he's also, very importantly, a freelance science communicator. In fact, I first met Simon when I was a judge in a competition called FameLab for science communication, and very tough competition, and Simon got through to the finals at that and did very well. So this is a very important, good debate for him in terms of science communication. Very appropriate he should be a judge here today. And then finally, of our individual judges, we have Graham Tiffany. Graham is an experienced debating matters judge, just actually being one of the panel judges. He's a youth community worker. His practice focuses on inner city areas with high levels of social exclusion, and he freelances as a lecturer, trainer and researcher and consultant on that. And he also manages a York-based community philosophy project. So there are individual judges. They've worked hard all day and they're still working. We then have our panel judges. First of all, we have Dr. Jack Walters, who's the Vice President of External Medical Affairs at Pfizer. Pfizer are obviously partners of ours on the Debating Matters competition. Jack has actually come from New York to be a judge here today, which is great to have got him to travel quite so far. He actually works on healthcare issues around the world and represents Pfizer on matters of human rights, corporate social responsibility and philanthropy. And he's particularly interested in raising the political will to fight against HIV and AIDS in Africa and Russia. And obviously for Pfizer and for a pharmaceutical company like Pfizer and for anybody who's interested in healthcare, the debate about caution and precaution and risk assessment, very key. I'm sure you'll be listening very hard, trying to learn something here today. We then have Nicolette Jones, who's a freelance literary critic, writes regularly in the broadsheets about literature. She has her own book out at the moment, much acclaimed and award-winning, The Plimsoll Sensation, The Great Campaign to Save Lives at Sea, which is actually a very important, it's probably one of the most important issues where the whole issue of risk and risk assessment came into the public area and was a matter of great public debate in England in history. And she's brought that to light today, so that'll be interesting to get her take on the issue. She has her own experience of debating and is an undergraduate, toured Australia and New Zealand as a member of the Oxford Union debating team. And then finally, we have our third judge, Austin Williams, who's the director of the Future Cities Project. He's an architect by profession and author of Shortcuts, Essential Guides for Building Designers, which is works for NBS, whose head office is in Newcastle. He's also a columnist for the Daily Telegraph, the Times Literary Supplement, Times Higher. He's written for Top Gear, New Humanist and various other publications. He's got a forthcoming book out entitled Enemies of Progress, Challenging the Orthodoxies of Sustainability and Environmentalism. He's very much interested in the whole risk issue. And he's also an originator and organiser of Bookshop Barney's in London, which is a robust exchange of ideas about current books. So he's kind of got a particular interest in the debating issue. Okay, can we give a big welcome to our judges? Back to the They're all lovely people. I'm going to be very nice to them. Okay, now let's reintroduce our debaters. And obviously, well done for getting here, and good luck as the day goes on, as the debate goes on. Right, the first person for the motion from Brighton is Katie Searles. Katie, give a big wave. That's right. Katie is studying history, politics, and English literature, and is recently back from Ethiopia, where she and others helped set up a daycare centre for children. And she's also going to study, or hopes to study, politics at university. The second person, the first person against the motion from Queen Elizabeth is Chris Wakefield. Chris is studying Tudor history, law, theatre studies, sociology and general studies. He's applied to university to read archaeology. Outside college, he enjoys taekwondo and watching films. And in his gap year, Chris hopes to go to Hong Kong to learn more about different cultures. The second person for the motion is Louise Marshall. Louise is studying A-levels in Spanish, history, geography and biology. She plays the cello and piano to grade 6 standard and is a member of the Gateshead Youth Orchestra and a branch of the Live Youth Theatre. And then the second person to argue against the motion is James Metcalf. James is studying A-level law, history, computing and maths. He has a place at university to study law and would like to be a barrister, but in case you think that makes him sound hard-nosed, he enjoys reading and he likes novels like Jane Eyre. He also plays drums for a local band and he's an amateur chef, so a bit of a Renaissance man all round. Can we give a big welcome to the... Right, I'm chairing and I'm a nervous wreck, so God knows what you lot are like. So, good luck everybody, hope it goes well. Yeah, you can stay seated, I was just about to say, stay seated or stand up as you will, make any decision you want. Yeah, they're fighting amongst themselves. Sort that out. Whatever you feel comfortable with. You get 3 minutes each, as you know. I will then hit the glass at two and a half minutes to give you 30-second warning. You know the rules. Good luck, everybody. Important motion. Okay, arguing for the motion from Brighton, big round of applause for Katie Searles.
We will be arguing scientists should adopt the precautionary principle. I will look at the idea that scientists do have self-interest and they aren't always right, and Louise will discuss the effects of not using the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle, according to the 1998 Wingspread Statement, when an activity raises threats of harm to the environment or human health, precautionary measures should be taken, even if some cause and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. It carries the sense of foresight and preparation, not merely caution. Isn't this just common sense? The principle applies to human health and the environment. The ethical assumption behind the precautionary principle is that humans are responsible to protect, preserve, and restore the global ecosystems on which all life, including our own, depends. Therefore, is it right for us to use animals and the earth as tools for our technological and scientific advancements? Shouldn't we explore the risks on them too? Shouldn't we err on the side of caution, as some of the ideas which are put into practice will not benefit all walks of life? Farmers could be put out of business, for example, if animal cloning went into mass production. But also, there seems to be no regard for the well-being of animals and the ideas of things like chickens being bred without feathers simply for the convenience after they are killed. Couldn't it be said that this is just scientists' self-interest? Scientists are not always neutral. They will have deadlines and targets to meet, and interest groups will also target them. Of course, money always equals power. So where the money is present, it will be more likely that scientific research will be based. People will target scientists as they can use their research in positive ways to promote products. Just look at shampoo adverts. Things scientists say are assumed to be right. Who is to say that scientists are right? It seems to be the general consensus that what scientists say Where were scientists telling us to think of the potential risks when smoking was introduced? Nowhere, because there was money to be made and they didn't adopt the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle is not simply the idea that science and technology shouldn't move forward, simply that scientists could use methods to test things as far as possible, exploring alternatives to possibly harmful actions, especially clean technologies that eliminate waste and toxic substances, placing the burden of proof on proponents of activity rather than on victims or potential victims of the activity, setting and working towards goals that protect health and the environment, and bringing democracy and transparency to the decisions affecting the health and environment. It is sometimes difficult to tell how much scientists have gone wrong when a disaster has taken place, and if they could have prevented it, using the precautionary principle would help prevent fatal mistakes and scientists from taking undue blame. We would truly know where to put the blame and what areas need more research in the future. So isn't it better to be safe rather than sorry and uphold the precautionary principle?
Thank you very much. Perfect timing. And arguing against from Queen Elizabeth. Big round of applause for Chris Wakefield.
Okay, firstly, I would like to say that many scientific and technological developments do raise possible threats of harm. Therefore, these possible threats could lead to an excessive preoccupation with hypothetical risks, which will be detrimental to scientific progress. I would just like to start off by giving you an example of what would have happened if the precautionary principle would have been adopted 100 years ago or 200 years ago, say. For example, look at the effect that science has on medicine. If the precautionary principle had been implemented, we wouldn't have vaccines, we wouldn't have penicillin, we wouldn't have antibiotics, and we certainly wouldn't have aspirin, an example I'll come back to later. I'd just like to throw it open to the audience here. I mean, I'm willing to guess a majority of you will have used aspirin at some point in your lives. And I think this is definitely a benefit to society, having a drug that helps people in a number of areas. I'll move on to transport. Had the precautionary principle been applied, aeroplanes, railways, cars, or even bicycles would have been implemented due to their hypothetical risks associated with them. I would also like to go on to things that we use every day, such as power and electricity. These are generated through gas, electricity, and nuclear power, all of which were employed by, scientists making advancements, which they wouldn't have made had the precautionary principle made them so obsessed with risk assessment that they would not have proceeded with these. I would now like to move on to argue that the precautionary principle is based on risks that might occur. Now, if there is no predicted risk of harm, this doesn't necessarily mean that no harm will occur, and likewise, just because harm is predicted doesn't mean it will occur. Therefore, this is potentially very damaging to advancement because people are never actually certain of what will happen unless they try it out. People can only weigh up hypothetical risk to a certain extent. And the only way to... You can't prove a hypothesis, you can only disprove one. So therefore, the precautionary principle is detrimental to progress, like I've mentioned. Now, a lot of the precautionary principle is based on this weighing up of risks I've mentioned already. Now, if we apply this to medicinal drugs, if a drug has harmful side effects, then the production is stopped, which prevents harm from occurring. But what if a drug is incorrectly withheld? What about the invisible victims that this creates? For example, cancer drugs that are held back because side effects may occur. What about the people who are suffering from cancer and who are dying without this potential drug? Is this not creating an invisible victim that people will ignore and instead only take up those who have had harmful side effects happen to them? And I mentioned aspirin as well before. The renowned scientist Peter McNaughton, who is a professor at Cambridge, argued that aspirin would never have been widely used had it not been the precautionary principle. Aspirin, as you're probably well aware, is used to treat people who have pain and cause pain relief. But it's also an incredibly important aspect in treating heart disease, cancer, and the prevention of deep vein thrombosis. Without something as widespread and as important as aspirin, we would have the problem of people not having the access to this drug and how much pain and suffering would this cause. So therefore, I would argue that scientists should not adapt to the precautionary principle.
Thank you very much. So, great start. Okay, and arguing secondly for the motion from Wrighton is Louise Marshall. Big round of applause.
As you discussed previously, scientists are not always right and often have selfish intent when researching products. My argument, on the other hand, will focus on the risks we take by not adopting the precautionary principle and if it is worth it. The precautionary principle is a way to change our behaviour, personally and collectively, to help prevent disasters, death and irreversible changes for future generations. And in extreme cases, if we had adopted the precautionary principle, we could prevent a disaster. For example, last year, on March 13th, six men were left fighting for their lives in hospital following a routine pharmaceutical experiment that went disastrously wrong. Soon after being injected with the TGN-1412 drug, six of the eight medical volunteers were screaming in terror, ripping off their clothes and claiming their heads were going to explode. One patient's head even swelled up to three times its normal size, something of an irony considering the drug was actually intended as an anti-inflammatory. This is just one of the many experiments carried out each year all over the world that were not researched in enough depth to ensure safety, yet tested on humans and the environment, regardless of effects. Adopting the precautionary principle meant that this may not have happened. The precautionary principle works on the basis that, instead of asking how much toxic damage is acceptable in a baby, or how much damage an ecosystem can take, we ask how much we can stop. Is it safe to be living in a world with over 30,000 chemicals, many of them toxic, 1,400 suspected or known carcinogenic, yet with only 7% of them having had extensive research done on to ensure their safety? It may also surprise you to know that most chemicals and other products are considered safe until proven otherwise. I, for one, do not want to be using a product containing a chemical that has connotations with cancer, or to be throwing away waste that contains poisonous materials that will pollute the planet. The planet that we see fit to destroy is only our planet for a short space of time. What about future generations to come? Do scientists and us as a society not have a responsibility to future generations to act in a responsible way? It is better to prevent future disasters than trying to reverse what has already been done. One area where even the EU is recognising the need to impose the precautionary principle is on GM crops. There is no need for GM food. We have sufficient food on this planet for its inhabitants. It's not a case of growing more, but moving around what we already have. Yet the Americans have been eating GM baguettes. But how do we know this makes it safe? The only symptoms of effect that GM crops will produce will be short-term, noticeable symptoms, for example, being sick. In the long run, how do we know? In adopting the precautionary principle before it's too late, we can prevent the spread of alien DNA within our systems and protect future generations. The precautionary principle is not about preventing growth or development. It is about preventing damage. It is common sense. Have you never been told to look before you leap? The precautionary principle is taking this and putting it into practice. It is merely taking precautions in the face of scientific uncertainty, finding alternative actions and placing the blame on truly those responsible.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Louise. And the final person formally arguing against the motion from Queen Elizabeth, a big round of applause for James Metcalfe.
As you heard, last year there was a pharmaceutical experiment that went wrong. There were people screaming with terror. One person had their head three times the size it was meant to be. If we'd known that would have happened, whether we adopt the precautionary principle or not, we would not have gone ahead with it. So, if we can't foresee a risk, as we couldn't in that situation, how can the precautionary principle be applied in the first place? It makes no sense. I'm going to talk about human evolution. Scientifically, whenever there's been a big discovery, you know, one of the first that came to my mind, science discovery, is fire. When humans discover fire, they didn't think, oh, it's hot, we might burn ourselves. Let's stand back and not touch it. We thought, how can we use this? What benefits might this have? Can this keep our children warm? Can this cook our meals to make them safer? Inevitably, there are risks involved. But I'll take one example. Chlorine is a very dangerous gas, and I think any scientist in this room will appreciate that. And we put it in our drinking water supply. Now, obviously, there seems to be a risk there on face value, but putting chlorine in a drinking supply and in swimming pools actually makes things more safe for us. Sometimes taking that risk, taking that chance, can make things more safe for us. And that's how we feel. There have been an exponential number of innovations in science in the last 20 years. Many are by accident or by chance, and many are in scientific experiments that are unrelated that may not have taken place if this precautionary principle applied. People might say there is more risk than there used to be with these new advances. You know, with the atomic bomb there comes more risk and things like that. We accept that there might be more risk with new advances, but what we say is the risks have always been broadly the same. Of course there are new risks, but our perception of these risks in the last 20 years has advanced to a stage where we see risk everywhere. I mean, my dad, when he goes into the office, every week he has to do a risk assessment on anything he does. And I agree, it's a good thing. We should err on the side of caution. We agree with that. We're not advocating scientists should be reckless. We're just saying we shouldn't be ridiculous to the point of saying, no, you can't use a Bunsen burner because it might fall over and set some paper on fire and someone will burn their hand. We think there is a line that must be drawn that says, okay, that's taken a bit too far. We think that the precautionary principle fails to balance long and short-term interests with long and short-term benefits. For example, there might be a short-term harm involved with something that would actually lead to a long-term benefit. And we feel that using the precautionary principle does stop that short-term harm, but you miss out on that long-term benefit that may be even bigger to society. And we feel that scientists should have the right to determine what might or might not be a benefit themselves without having strict rules and guidelines to adhere to. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to turn to the judges now to ask questions to Katie and these from writing. If I can get Jack, if you could ask first, Jack, Austin and Nicolette, if you could pose your questions just to these two, and you think about them and so on. Yeah,
excellent debate, thank you very much. I have two questions. The first one, Katie, you talked about smoking and had there been scientists, they weighed in on where were the scientists when smoking was introduced? And I'm not sure what you meant by that, because smoking, of course, was introduced very long time ago, and I'm not sure what state science was at that stage. So I wanted you to develop that argument a little bit. And secondly, I wanted to just ask Louise about what evidence you had that the Northbrook Park drug, the one that went so wrong in that phase one study and helped to volunteer, what evidence do you have that that hadn't been sufficiently researched before it went to first in human?
Okay, thanks. Austin?
Again, a very impressive presentation. Just on Louise's point when she said, have I not heard of look before you leap, I always thought that the precaution principle was working out whether you wanted to leap in the first place. So there's assessments that it's not just taking a kind of caution, but precaution and assessing whether these things need to be done. So I just want to take a look at what you see as being risky activity. What do you think the difference between risk and harm? Because you raised the whole ethical dimension, Katie, on protect, preserve ecosystems. From what? Is what I want to know. What do you see as being the harmful activities that are threatening them? And then secondly, I suppose following on from what the lads have said, is that do you not think that the precaution principle is actually inherently delaying development? So it's putting a brake on development rather than actually being anything necessarily progressive.
Okay, and Nicholas, perhaps also.
I'm interested in the question that Katie raised about money being power, and that there's a and that the self-interest of scientists is often about there being money behind it, and so somebody is paying for them to find particular results or to achieve particular ends. I want to give you some more examples where you think that this is the case. I'm also interested, this is a small point, you said something about the risk of breeding chickens without feathers. Now, I couldn't quite work out why that's a risky activity. It's risky for the chickens. I just wondered if that example quite fitted into the argument. And again, on the economic question, Louise, perhaps you could tell me a bit more about the issue of cost. And that one of the problems about introducing the precautionary principle is that it's sometimes so expensive to do the research required to achieve scientific certainty before you undergo the research that it actually it's financially prohibitive.
Anything you want to pick up on, either of you?
Just the idea about smoking, that sort of ties in with Nicolette's question about the idea of money. It's more just like, not that people will pay for a result, but people, like, somebody has to be interested and think, I'm sure we could make money out of this, or I'm sure this would, like, at the end of the day, why do we need to further technology, and, like, what gains do that have? Obviously, like, people are obviously going to buy into this technology, which is making people money, which is making scientists money. I'm not saying that it's entirely selfish and that they're only doing anything to make loads and loads of money. But there is this idea that, like, why would it? Who is a scientist? Somebody who graduates from university with a science degree, and in some cases, we're putting our lives in their hands. And who's to say that this person's right? At the end of the day, it is kind of a job, and they only have resources, and they only further these technological advancements because of money, really. And there's no other reason for it. Obviously, to find cures for certain diseases and things like that. But then why do we need to produce chickens without feathers was my sort of argument. I completely understand why they would like try and develop technology to do with drugs and things like that. But in terms of ease, for when you cook a chicken that like you don't have to pull its feathers off, I don't understand if something could go wrong with that and cause somebody to be ill, why would you bother doing that? Because it doesn't have any real benefit to someone. It's not going to cure them with disease, it's just for ease.
So part of the question is whether there's enough benefit, but also you don't believe in the nature because you don't trust scientists necessarily. They need regulation because they're going to be so interested in bias.
There is an element of that, not that computer scientists are untrustworthy, but there is this sort of air like around scientists that
because they're human.
Exactly.
Okay. What about you, Louise? Anything
else? Well, I'd like to pick up on the. Some of them were sort of similar points about scientific certainty and sufficient research. There is never 100% negative in science. You can't have 100% negative. And we're not standing here to say we should adopt the precautionary principle in every single aspect of life. Of course you can't. It would be too costly for a start and too hard. But the fact of the matter is, if we have to weigh up whether life is more important, whether... Because we're surviving fine as a planet as we are. They're a disease, yes. And they're trying to combat that. But we have to decide ourselves if life is more important than fully producing something. Because if you don't fully test something that you know could be dangerous, in putting it through trials, you still can't prove if it's going to be dangerous. But if it's going to be dangerous and is massively produced and massively consumed, then you can cause an epidemic in... We can cause death, but the precautionary principle can prevent the death that it could be caused.
To address Officer's question, is the idea of the precautionary principle isn't simply like the idea that we don't fear the technology or science. So it's just exploring alternatives to something that could be harmful, or looking at just different ways of furthering investigation as to how this may affect somebody if it was to, like... There isn't apparently now that we've discovered there isn't a problem with aspirins, but what would happen if they found out that there had been? Then people might have changed their mind if they use it every day. If they found out that there was something wrong with it, then they'd say, well, why wasn't this tested to the very end? Why is this happening if it's mass produced?
Anything you
want
to push on?
Yeah, it's ifs and buts, isn't it? It's a ridiculous argument. I mean, the point is, I was saying you're delaying development. So what you're saying is, if I was to say to you, what if there can be shown, or if I can assess, that there are massive benefits to GM food? See, you've made a political decision that you think there's negative aspects of GM food, and therefore you want to have it researched to the nth degree, and you want to put a brake on it until some of your own petty worries are dealt with. I think there are fantastic benefits to GM crops.
Thank you. Thank
and therefore,
you.
I think the caution principle is actually delaying the development of that.
Can I come back to that?
Yes, of course you can. Yes. Fine, girls, fine.
I'm not going to fight. But the thing is, there has been quite a lot of research done into GM foods, and they found transgenic DNA, which was something that wasn't supposed to move. They tested it on mice, and it wasn't supposed to move into the bloodstream of mice. And this is a possibly mutative DNA. It has connotations with cancer, and it could be extremely harmful. But the DNA was found in the samples of the bloodstream, and even in some of the cells. So from the cells that we're reproducing with this alien DNA in. And they also tested it on pregnant mice. And the DNA had not only not been destroyed, it found its way through the placenta into the baby mice, which is possible mutative cancer-causing DNA. And if we carry on giving out GM food, letting them use GM food, without further researching this, you could potentially giving the whole world cancer, or giving them something that could seriously damage a lot of people.
Just as a people don't know how far, whether scientists have adopted the precautionary principle or not. You don't know that the GM products haven't adopted the precautionary principle, so therefore you can't really argue that scientists shouldn't use the precautionary principle if you're not sure whether they've used it or not.
Okay, thank you. We have to move on to the next Okay, sorry. Turning now, if I can ask Jack, can you address your questions to Queen Elizabeth, please?
Sure.
To Chris and James.
One question for each of you. As a doctor, I'm very engaged in the precautionary principle. Chris, excellent to talk about an example, to give people an example they can really focus on. Are you aware of any risks that there are associated with aspirin? Because it really has been presented as if it's absolutely safe and it's without risk. So I just wondered if you had any knowledge there. And James, are you aware of the you were talking that the precautionary principle had just been invented around 1990 something, but are you familiar with the edict from attributed sometimes to Hippocrates, but probably Galen, first do no harm, and in what context do you understand?
Okay, great, thanks. Nicolette?
Yes, in Chris's presentation, he talked a bit about how we wouldn't have had, for instance, aeroplanes or cars. I wonder, if we'd adopted a precautionary principle, cars, for instance, you could argue, are one of the blights of the planet, at least as they are now. Perhaps we would have found a way of introducing something, a benefit like this, and reducing the risk that we're now trying to reduce by reducing emissions and so on, fueling cars in different ways. If we'd begun with that, we might have done a lot less damage to the planet, you could argue. Some of the things that you described as benefits that we actually have, it seems to me, conceivably, with a bit more research and foresight and anticipation of this, we might have actually made a better world. So I'd perhaps like to back up that case a bit more. James made a lovely argument, was very convincing, I think, about the issue of us only being able to see foreseeable risks, and if it's an unforeseen risk, then it's a problem. But do you not think that if you don't have a precautionary principle, you give scientists a kind of carte blanche to do anything, and and fools rushing? You know, do we not need some kind of restriction in a world in which we recognise that the damage that we can do with our technological advances is huge?
Well, I was going to ask a similar question on the trains, planes, and automobiles comment that these wouldn't have happened had the precautionary principle been around 100 years ago or whatever, which is purely nonsense. The world will invent all sorts of weird, wonderful things regardless, and maybe there would be rubber cars which would have bounced off pedestrians and they wouldn't have 3,500 deaths every year. These things would have happened, but I'm sure we've been invented in some form or other. So that's one thing, which is I don't basically agree with your premise. Second thing is what James was saying, that your dad goes in and fills out risk assessment forms every day, as do I, as I'm sure most of us do. But I just want to know, I mean, a flip side to that question really is when that started to happen and why that started to happen, unless it's a historical continuity from the Greeks, which I don't believe.
As a hint. Either of you?
much of all.
Yeah, go on, Chris.
I appreciate your point about aspirin. I was, you know, trying to give an example there, and there are obviously risks associated with this. Yeah, so some people may have had an adverse reaction to the drug. But with our scientists trying these things out and progressing them, this would probably not be discovered. And surely the, well, I personally feel that the benefits of aspirin far outweigh the negative effects it has had. You know, just in the common day, you know, uses that it has, you know, been, it's implemented for, you know, just pain relief things, which has helped to make hundreds of people's lives a lot easier, and thousands even. And then I think we can't pass over this fact that it's incredibly important in the prevention of things like deep vein thrombosis and heart disease and cancer issues. Without aspirin, these diseases would feel, you know, a lot more unpleasant, even more painful for people to suffer from them. So I think that while they do have risks, I think, you know, it's this balancing up, isn't it, of things. And I think without this progression, you know, in forward, and the precaution principle is, it's basically holding back society to some extent.
You made a strong point. I think is what you're saying is that if it were to be brought to the market today under today's regulations, it wouldn't actually.
I think is what you were. And how, you know, how long would it be delayed in, you know, the introduction if it was ever introduced, and how many people would suffer in the meantime while this drug wasn't available to them? I mean, there are more recent examples of this new cancer drug that the NHS are refusing to pay some people for, and, you know, it's going to cost people £30,000. If this drug is implemented, you know, implemented, how much suffering is caused to people? I mean, surely the long-term and short-term benefits of this drug are vastly important and should not be, like, shouldn't be ignored by the Robin Cook's law, which, you know, only really takes into account the negative effects that it has.
I think that links into what we were saying as well about long and short-term benefits. In a case of a cancer patient, they're looking for the short-term because they're not going to be there in the long-term if nothing happens. And you've got the precautionary principle. What it doesn't do is balance those interests.
I think that's what we were...
Anything on the time-specific question? Yeah. Historic?
Right, I'm going to try and answer two questions in one here. It's quite bold, but I'm going for it. You said that Galen and Hippocrates and people like that, historically in medicine, have been focusing on, well, the Hippocratic Oath and early versions of that with Galen. That's focusing more on treatment of a patient that is already ill. And I think it's fair to say, I mean, I don't pretend to be a doctor, but if you've got a drug and you know there are side effects, but you think the benefits are in the best interest of the patient, for example, a drug that makes you need the loo for every 2 hours in the night, it's a risky public health, but, I mean, if it's going to make the patient better, you're willing to sacrifice certain parts of health for the greater sort of health. And with regard to the idea has been around for a long time, the idea has been around for a long time, but it was really in the 1960s, the Germans really focused on it and produced next to what the definition we have today is that you heard over there. And there have been a lot of influences on that. I mean, obviously there are the medical influences from long ago. But, I mean, evolution in law and society, I mean, negligence, influence from America about being able to sue people for the harm they cause. And I think one of the big influences on the precautionary principle is that people want to implement it because they don't want to be sued. And to be honest, limiting human advancement because somebody doesn't want to be sued, I don't see that as a justification.
Okay. All right. Unless you, is anyone desperate to push? Anyone?
I was going to just answer this you know, comment about rubber cars and whatnot, which I find quite fascinating.
You rubber cars.
I do accept that the precautionary principle, if that was to apply to cars and things, then maybe the environment would be in a better condition. But if we apply the precautionary principle today, then we would be able to come up with any technological changes to help make the environment a better place. We just have to rely on what we have now. And the precautionary principle would set back any, you know, renewable power source projects, things like geothermal energy, which has a great number of risks associated. These wouldn't be implemented, so, you know, climate change would continue to happen at perhaps a worse rate. And in the response to the question of rubber cars, well, even if the precautionary principle was applied, you know, society will find an alternative invention. But how long would that be delayed for? How long would that take in process? Would it take 100 years? Longer than 200 years?
Austin, very quickly.
Just quickly. When you're talking about benefits, are you talking about benefits to humanity or benefits to the planet? And if you say benefits to the planet, you give all the ground to the other side. Because if you think that we have to stop our harm to the planet, like, you know, maybe...
Well, no, I was saying benefits to, you know, humanity as a whole.
Well, I think one problem with the precaution principle is it contradicts itself in that term. It's a threat of harm to the environment and public health, and or public health, and sometimes the two can be in conflict. And as such, which do you value over the other? The precaution principle doesn't explain that. Sorry.
Can I say one thing quickly, that you made the very good point that you don't want scientists to be reckless. But the question is, if you don't institute the precautionary principle, how do you regulate? How do you make sure that they're not reckless? How do you ensure that they take proper responsibility?
Well, I mean,
one line is quick.
In any profession, you have to have responsibility, and there are always going to be regulations within that profession to ensure responsibility. For example, the medical... Sorry, can I just...
Quick!
For example, the medical profession has its own sort of organisation to make sure everything is responsible. Sorry.
Just a quick paragraph. Surely human nature has some form of basic instinct of morality that governs people's actions, and the majority of that.
I'm not sure that's enough. I think if you had that, you don't have to have a law against burglary.
Okay, right. Because the judges are so keen, when I go out to the audience for questions, if you want to compete with the audience, stick your hands up, I might take you. Well behaved. Right, girls. Give the boys a hard time.
Okay, just to begin with, you said about fires. I'm not aware that scientists deal with fire. And also the idea about the precautionary principle. Aren't we already upholding the precautionary principle? No one's really sure of the cause of global warming, yet we're being encouraged to recycle, and we're being encouraged to use less, to produce less carbon emissions. Wouldn't you say we're already adopting the precautionary principles through global warming?
First, just a quick response.
No, I've got to come back to you, don't worry. They can answer this bit at the hard time. Go on.
You say that scientists didn't discover fire. Scientists, by our definition, didn't discover fire, but, you know, with early man, you know...
Yeah, with universities to get a PhD.
Yeah, I mean, these people weren't going to be, you know, graduated in different, you know, disciplines. So I would argue that, you know, early scientists did discover fire. Fire's an element. Where it was on the periodic table.
But you concede that...
You can use that through natural means. You can get two pieces of, like, wood or whatever and rub them together. You can produce fire. You don't use chemicals to produce fire.
By your own argument, fire can be produced by these chemicals. And as you were talking about global warming, that's what this all links into. I mean, in theory, it's the industrialisation that began in the 1800s that used all these chemicals, that used fire, and put all this stuff up in the air.
And?
I'm saying that global warming.
Yeah, but that wasn't her point. You're not answering her point.
Sorry, well fire is
not... My main issue is the precautionary principle is being used to address global warming, even though scientists disagree amongst themselves as to the cause of global warming.
Well, that proves our point. How can you apply the precautionary principle to something that you don't understand? I mean...
But it is being applied.
How can you not apply the precautionary principle to something you don't understand? You can't just recklessly go head-on into absolutely everything, because if you did, there probably wouldn't be a planet left.
You say scientists they can't understand this. Well, worldwide, the definition of this precautionary principle you've applied, it's not generally agreed on by all scientists, so therefore all scientists do not agree on the definition of the precautionary principle.
We weren't advocating that scientists rush in recklessly and burn everything and see what happens.
But we're not saying that they don't do anything. I'm asking you, why are we being encouraged to, or aren't we being encouraged to recycle and to reduce carbon emissions, which is using the precautionary principles, which the majority of scientists would uphold, even if it hasn't been proven that this is the cause of global warming?
Right, just think about that for a minute, because it's quite a good question,
yeah.
Which has got you, and which you're not answering. Right.
You sort of touched on the point that all the risks are the same now as they always have been. How can you say that when now we have more knowledge, more power, and more money to discover potentially deadly things? You can't say that an experiment that was done in the 1600s had all of the same, like, things available to cause the risks that we have today. We have more equipment, we have more knowledge. You can't compare the two. We need a precautionary principle now to stop self-destruction.
Okay, with the first question that we were apparently stumped on, right? We aren't saying that in some cases that the threat of public health and environment should be disregarded. We're saying that it shouldn't apply in all cases. Obviously, with global warming and the environment, you do want that precaution. You want to recycle because the effects are very dangerous. But my point is, with many things, And to a certain extent, global warming, which is why there aren't massive initiatives to stop everyone driving all worldwide, you don't know what the results are going to be. You can't predict that risk. You can't say, well, with 100% certainty, well, if you do this, this will happen. Every case is going to be different. And as such, you can't realistically apply the precautionary principle because nobody can tell you exactly what is going to happen. Foresight is impossible. You can only make the best guess.
And you say that scientists are encouraging people to adopt this recycling strategy. Is the government, is it not, that are encouraging people?
So why
is the government decided? Well, there might be underlying political motives, you know, to save them money, to get them more kudos in Europe with other people. Is it necessarily, you know, do they have the interest of everyone in Hara? Are there ulterior motives underlying the quadratic principle?
Okay.
Necessarily the benefit of
okay, thanks. No, sorry. Okay, so you dealt with that. Now, can you give the girls some questions? You get a chance to answer them back.
Firstly, I was interested by a comment that why do we need to further technology? Well, I personally can think of a number of reasons. You know, we can improve healthcare, we can improve the quality of the environment or the quality of life. What reasons do you give for, you know, the fact that we can just stay as we are and we don't need to improve technology?
Well, you're saying that why should we fear technology and development? But what happens if that development itself is at the detriment of society and of the environment?
Sorry, can I just clarify that we're not arguing at all that technology shouldn't move forward and that we're fine as we are. That's not what we're saying.
Oh, I just thought you said why do we need to further technology?
The only point where I would find that there's not really a reason for certain technology is not really beneficial, such as the idea of the chickens without feathers. It's just convenience and there's just no need for it. But apart from that, we're not arguing that science shouldn't move forward and that technology shouldn't move forward. And we're not even saying that things should be completely test. Like, we're not saying that. We're just saying that there are alternatives people could explore which may have benefits in the long run that scientists won't explore because they'll go for the quickest, cheapest, easiest option.
And then isn't the element of science to preserve life? Isn't that what science is about, the preservation of life? And if we don't adopt the precautionary principle, isn't science just completely contradicting itself?
I wouldn't say science is about the preservation of life. I'd say science is the quest for understanding and knowledge rather than preservation of life, and that's a separate area.
Okay, thanks.
My question is more one of clarification. You said you don't want to apply the precautionary principle to every area of life, simply science. But you also said, as one of your arguments for the precautionary principle, isn't life more important than X or Y? So surely by that argument, you would apply it to every other area of life because life is the most important thing.
But I have my own responsibility. If I walk out in front of a bus, that's kind of my responsibility. I should have looked. If somebody is giving me a drug and saying, this will help you, this will... If someone had told me that aspirins weren't tested up until the last possible... as far as they possibly could, and money wasn't invested in this, I would maybe want to know why, or I would question. People don't know how much the precautionary principle is used, or that things have been tested, so they do what scientists say and just take these things because they assume that nothing will go wrong. Whereas if I'm going to make myself a cup of tea and it scalds me, that's my responsibility. I should have realised that.
We just mean, in general, like you need to take a little bit more care than we actually do. We're not saying... Like I said, there's no 100% negatives in science. You can't prove it to the very last degree, but we can prove it a lot more than we actually are, and we can prevent disasters that have happened.
Okay.
Prevent disasters that did happen.
No, be quiet.
Just clarifying that.
No, that's fine. So I'm going to go out to the audience. Obviously, you get a lot of chance to come back in this session, slightly less under pressure of time. Say your name and your school, if it's appropriate, in terms of individual prizes, otherwise just say your name. Okay, we'll just start in there. Go on.
Yeah, I'm Andrew.
Not from school, so...
Yeah. No. I'm losing it. Wait a second.
No, right, Andrew, I'll come back to you in a minute, Andrew.
You.
Right, so bear that thought. Yes.
Rebecca Harding, Church High School. There is the theory, which is supported by quite a few scientists, that human evolution is basically... coming to a standstill, but the evolution of harmful external influences isn't. And wouldn't you say that the precautionary principle is inhibiting technological advancements which can combat these external influences, and therefore a more practical alternative, such as a precautionary principle, would be more suitable?
Okay, thanks.
second?
Yes, you.
Okay. If the precautionary Deborah Britland from McClim School. If the precautionary principle was to come into effect, you've mentioned before about the cost of this research and this testing on things like chemicals. Where would this money come from? How would you fund this research?
Okay, thanks.
To both of them, Emma Sadler from Church High School. It's kind of both sides. No one actually said who should make the decision whether or not the precautionary principle should be adopted.
Okay, thank you.
One to this side, which is, it's been raised since out of the room, but you're going to take a precautionary approach to things which I think basically things are going to affect wider society. Why don't you apply the precautionary principle to itself and justify it in certain terms? Because I'd like to see you try and do that. And to this side, if there is a chance we're going to wipe everyone out, what's the point in progress anyway if we're not here?
Jade Wall from Wickham School.
Sorry, can you just speak up a bit, Jade?
Jade from Wickham School, yeah. A question to both teams, really. I just wonder if you could define what you believe the precautionary principle to be, because I don't really feel it's been clarified. Both of you are really dealing in extremes. You're talking about sort of not doing things, and you're talking about just going straight into it. I believe that the precautionary principle was different to cost-benefit, because it's if there's an indication of a risk rather than if the risk's proven. So can you just sort of clarify what you believe the definition to be?
Okay, now I'll take you now, yeah. And then you can answer.
The girls are saying about how scientists are greedy and they're selfish in what they're doing, and if they say to people, you take these things, that people should expect them to be okay. Why don't people take the initiative and make sure that things are okay? Not just take scientists as some sort of godlike people, maybe that we should do something, and then that would, instead of enforcing sort of the precautionary principle, maybe by our actions we would get them to do things in a better way.
Okay, thanks. Now, I know that you three, and then Jay just put Anne up again, but I know you three, and I'll come straight back to you. Anything you want to pick up on, girls?
Just to begin with, just these questions, I think it applies to a lot of the questions. When people are talking about the precautionary principle, how much is this going to cost? How much would technology move forward? Does anybody actually know in specific cases where the precautionary principle is being used? Because it's not something that we've come up with. It's not something that's never been thought of before. Scientists apply the precautionary principle. We're just saying scientists should always apply the precautionary principle. The idea that scientists... The idea about money that you were discussing, I don't think that's really the issue. I think that if there are certain things, we're not discussing where the scientists are going to get this funding from for the precautionary principle. We're saying that they should uphold it. And if the government needs to put funding in this, if this means that it's going to prevent nuclear disasters or anything like that, then I think that the money would be able to be found.
Lewis, I'll come back to you. I'm going to take one of the boys and then come back to you.
I've got two things I want to address. One was the point made at the front that if you apply the precautionary principle yourself, that was something I was saving to the end, so that it would hopefully have an effect. But basically, applying the precautionary principle to itself does undermine the principle. You know, by your definition I'm using here, the threat of harm to the environment and public health, you seem quite into the idea of cancer patients and things like that. By applying the precautionary principle, you may lose out on a cancer cure, and that is a threat to public health. The precaution principle does contradict itself, as the point was made there. And
right, it's okay, we'll come back to you. Okay,
it was sort of on the issue of cost. If you are saying that the precautionary principle is moving away from cost-benefit analysis, but in a way you have got away at the costs and the benefits, because is the cost of life better than the cost of money? Because if we really cared about preserving life and preserving ourselves as we know it, to keep survival, would we find the money from somewhere? Because if we genuinely want to preserve ourselves, we can find the money. And
let me come to Chris and then I'll come back to you, so it's fine.
I think it was mentioned, you know, that the precautionary principle deals with risk assessment, but that doesn't take into account any of the benefits that you know, a scientific decision will have. So if there, you know, if there's a couple of risks associated with it, but you know, a huge long list of benefits, and you know, this whatever is being, you know, analysed, that might not be able to see the light of day. And I think the point made about what's the point of progress if everyone's being wiped out, I think it's very unlikely that people are going to just, you know, destroy the human race overnight. You know, it's not kind of cold war era anymore or any kind of unstable climate. So therefore, I think that, you know, if the precautionary principle isn't applied, then it's unlikely that humanity is going to completely destroy itself from the inside.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I know, there's a lot of people. Anything quick before I go out, because I'm going to come to you.
I was just going to address the point that it just raised there, actually, about scientists taking the precautionary principle and wipe people out, just in terms of like nuclear disasters. I think that scientists should adopt the precautionary principle because it's good. Also, Andrew, I think, was your point. All I would say is we place our trust in scientists because we expect that they will do everything possible to make sure that we're going to be okay. If you're talking about scientists in terms of doctors or people who are writing out prescriptions, if you're in a hospital, there's not a lot you can do if someone's injecting a drug into you because you're about to die. Therefore, we put our trust in scientists, therefore they should be taking precautionary measures to make sure we're going to be okay at the end of it.
And if we... If we believe scientists because that's how we've been brought up to do, scientists are right. We've been told that since we were little. So maybe to adopt precautionary principle, we'll have to try and change the perspective of the people.
Perception. Okay. Thank you.
You said for like drugs like aspirin.
Yeah, name, sorry.
Oh, Becky Salisbury from Westfield. You said for drugs like aspirin, you would want them to be researched enough to make sure they're safe. Well, if the precautionary principle was adopted, wouldn't that prevent it because the research would be potentially risky?
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Mine was to the...
Your name?
Tansy Ford from Wickham. Mine was to the people from Queen's College. You said about carbon emissions from cars and how now we shouldn't adopt the precautionary principle because we need to make developments in it to change the way we've made it now. Well, maybe if we'd taken the precautionary principle in the first place, we wouldn't need to rush into things now. And shouldn't we take it now, just take the precautionary principle now, just in case we make the same mistakes again? I bet when they introduced cars in the first place, they didn't think that what was going to happen to the planet. If we jump, go straight into it again, trying to right it, we could make it even worse if we don't adopt the principle.
Okay, Nicolette?
I just want to take Louise up on the... Very good point. You said that if we're going to save lives, it's worth any amount of money, in fact, doing it. But what about the argument that you might have to spend a vast fortune proving that something is, in fact, already safe? And that might be money that you could use to develop the drug, distribute the drug, whatever, and actually increase its benefits. One of the problems about introducing the principle is that you're asking people to spend a lot of money, which might not actually be a gain in the long run. It just says, okay, it's what you thought it was.
Okay, yes.
Zoo Church High. I'm just wondering if Louise and Katie have anything to say about the fact that there might be a couple of fundamental flaws behind the precautionary principle, in that it requires those who wish to sort of proceed with scientific activities to prove a negative, and also that the precautionary principle seems to sort of say that a lack of evidence that something might be a problem isn't a reason for not taking action, as if it were a problem, which effectively says that action without evidence is justified.
Okay, Graham Tiffany.
Yeah, it seems to me that much of the debate is more about what you might call the ethical foundations of science. And I'd just like to ask both teams whether or not they believe their argument to be more in tune with those ethical dimensions than the other.
Okay, great. I'm going to take you two, and then I'll come back to Jade after the break. So I'm going to take you two, then get another round, and then I can take a quick round, and then you can sum up. Yeah. Okay. So yes.
Katie said you need.
Rebecca
Passler from Queen Mother. Katie, you said you need to always apply the precautionary principle. However, we often need to make mistakes to learn from them, and therefore advance. So how is this possible if we're not allowed to make these mistakes and test the limits in the first place?
Okay, thank you.
I was just wondering whether you... Rebecca Harding, Church High. Wouldn't you say that the tendency of the precautionary principle is to focus on how big the risks are rather than the chance of them actually happening?
Okay, thank you. I'm going to start this time with James. Do you want to pick up one?
I had a point about cars, and if we take the precautionary principle, then we might not have ever used them. I don't think that's true, because at the time when cars were invented, 100 years ago, people didn't really recognise the risks of the environment with regard to global warming, as we may do now. People might not recognise that the cars did cause this pollution, and as such, the risk was unforeseeable, which is exactly the point we were making about the precautionary principle. It doesn't see all the risks.
Okay, thank you. Louise, anything you want to pick up?
Um,
or so much?
You're saying that there's fundamental flaws because those who wish for scientific, like on in the basis of the precautionary principle, you have to have 100% negative. That is the statement of the precautionary principle, but we've already said you can't have an 100% scientific negative. We're not saying you have to have 100% scientific negative. It's just we're saying that you should try and test it as far as you can to ensure the safety of human beings and the planet.
Okay, thanks. Chris, anything you want to say?
I'd just like to pick up on you were giving the example of someone who's about to die being given drugs that might have a bad side effect. Isn't it better that they live and actually have these adverse side effects rather than dying? Would that not be, you know, preferable to death?
Katie, anything you want to pick up?
I wouldn't say that that was really relevant to what we're talking about in terms of that's about talking about whether to give somebody a right to life or whether they want to live with like a mental disability or like
sure,
physical difficulty.
That's the ethical foundation mentioned by one of the questions. Is that not possible?
Yeah, but doctors talk about, like, if you're talking about the ethical dimensions of doctors, like, about the rights to life, and like doctors have to save lives where possible, like, so then that does go with the ethical principles.
Okay, so gather your thoughts for your final comments. When I come back to you next, you'll be both answering any question and giving us your final thoughts. Any last thoughts? I know that Jane wants to speak. Is there anyone else? I just want to see hands in the air now for the final round. Okay, not compulsory. But yes, okay, Jade.
To the boys, it seemed your main point was about time and how it would delay discoveries. If you had a child and you were trying to teach it road safety, would you just push it out into the middle of traffic in the fact that it would learn quicker than if you sat and explained, well, first you've got to look this way, then that way, and then, you know, learn, go through the theory first. Would it learn quicker, or is it worth the risk that the child might get run over for the sake of that time?
Okay, yeah.
This idea that if only we'd done this hundreds of years ago, we wouldn't have this and we wouldn't have the problem. It just seemed that now we have a society that's so see-through with the internet and media and globalisation that this sort of issue has really come to the front, whereas before really it wasn't considered. This was people individually around the world coming up with ideas, inventing things, and then them spreading. It seems that you couldn't really have possibly enforced the precaution principle hundreds of years ago.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
I think I want to urge the teams to address Rebecca's question from just now, because both teams seem to be saying that the precautionary principle is more applicable in some circumstances than others. So I think it would be really interesting to hear something about when are we looking at the small chance of a very big disaster or the likelihood of a series of small disasters, and where is the precautionary principle more applicable?
Okay, great. Okay, so I'm going to take basically these four hands and then I'm going to come back to you. So, yes, right.
Emma, Church High School. I think Louise Harvest believed that Harvest Research in enough depth to ensure safety. Sadly, of course, it's not possible to ensure safety. Life is dangerous, and adopting a precautionary principle might make it slightly less so, but at the cost of scientific process, which I think is too high.
Okay, thank you. And behind?
If the precautionary principle were adopted, it would become a lot more costly and a lot more difficult to get sort of experiments and actions approved. Do you think that maybe there'll be a decline in sort of scientific activity because people will train in other professions where it's just easier to get ahead without all this regulation?
Wouldn't you say that, for example, if you were given the case where you had 4 weeks left to live and someone offered you an innovative drug that hadn't been thoroughly tested, you didn't know all the risks of it, but wouldn't you rather take that and have the chance of life than know you were going to die anyway?
Doesn't, in your opinion, the precautionary principle involve bringing sort of lay involvement into the scientific decision making? Wouldn't that actually help benefit the public understanding and actually build trust in science to adopt the precautionary principle rather than simply compare it? And to this side, you criticised scientists for trying to do things cheaply. Well, surely if scientists are doing it cheaply, it means they can do more of things, research things faster. So I'm not sure that understands that as an argument against scientists.
Okay, thank you very much. Some excellent questions there. I'd particularly like to say, well done to Wickham and Church High. He really wouldn't shut up, which is what we like to hear. You might not be on the panel, but we're not going to be able to ignore you. Right, good. Okay, in the order in which you spoke, for yours, if anything you want to pick up in your final remarks, Starting with you, Katie, please.
Okay, just to pick up on your argument there, that just furthers my argument that scientists have self-interest. If you don't go into a profession because you think that you won't be able to gain out of it, then you shouldn't be in the profession in the first place. If it's about furthering drugs, like to do, if it's to do with like drugs and helping people, and you're and you can't further or get money out of it or whatever, then you shouldn't be in that. And about the idea about doing things cheaply, I would mean that scientists might rush through something because otherwise it would cost too much money. So I'm saying that by using their money more effectively and testing every means possible rather than coming up with testing every means possible, they should do that rather than try and get things through to save money. And we aren't saying that people shouldn't do things for fear of knocking over a Bunsen burner or whatever. We're just saying that people should look on the side of caution. And we're not. There's nothing in the precautionary principle saying that scientists and technology shouldn't move forward. Simply explore the other alternatives of coming to the same ends as you would without adopting the precautionary principle.
Okay, thank you very much, Kate.
I'm going to close by reiterating the point that the scientific and technological developments will be so detrimentally affected that, you know, any benefits would just be eradicated. Surely the numerous technological advances and, you know, how these relate to medicine are more important than, you know, the negatives. Surely a society where science and technology advance is one that's preferable to one that regresses or, you know, moves backwards in itself. So therefore, I would argue that because of the assessment of hypothetical risk, which is essentially guesswork, that we should not adopt the precautionary principle. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Final remarks then from Louise, but they're just on the bearing. It's okay.
I'm
confused. No,
they're not
what
he's saying. Okay. Just, there's so many points I don't really think I can do them all. But I'd just like to make on the point of global warming. We've done the damage. It's not reversible. We can't change what's happened, but we can stop it. The precautionary principle is not only to be used to prevent further damage, it's to stop damage that's already been done. We're not saying that in adopting the precautionary principle, we're going to stop further development. All the world needs to develop, but we suggest that you can use the precautionary principle and work it together with development to make a safer, cleaner, more stable future than the world we're living in today.
Thank you very much. Everyone's so efficient. Right, okay, and then finally, James.
We've just heard that you cannot change global warming, it is irreversible. I'm not sure whether or not that's true, but if it was true, surely we should go for the advances we can now anyway, because it's irreversible.
Didn't understand that.
I'm going to finish by saying that scientists, on the whole, are responsible people. If there is a big problem apparent with something they're looking into and researching, they tend not to pursue it. They'll say, oh, look, there's a problem with that. They are responsible. There are scientists that do pursue that, you know. They'll go in and they'll do it anyway because they think there might be money in it or whatever. But that abuse would more than likely happen under the precautionary principle anyway. This is what we're talking about existing already in scientific society is a less extreme version of the precautionary principle. We're not saying people should be reckless and jump straight in at the deep end and see how deep it is. We're saying that people shouldn't take it too far and not go in the water at all for fear they'll get their feet wet and their feet won't look good wet. We're saying we want to look on the side of caution. We're not advocating recklessness. We just don't want to take that too far and hinder so many scientific advancements that might happen if we don't.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, well done everyone. You can sort of relax, although now you're going to be criticised. But I mean, you don't have to say anything anymore. You can obviously, after this is over, go up and attack the judges for what they say. But for now, okay. I want to start with Jack, Austin, and Nicolette. Can you give us both individually and as a team some comments on writing Katie Moody's piece, Jack?
Very passionate. I felt that you didn't move from your initial position. I also was very surprised that no one talked about ethics until it came as a question from the floor. I was particularly surprised because
You appear to feel that it was all to do with financial gain, rather than when people were talking about there were other things. You didn't appear to hear that either, so I was a bit disappointed in that, but certainly very passionate discussion.
Okay, thank you. And Austin?
I'll start with the good part, which, and this is a general across the table, I've been on a few of these panels, and it was probably one of the most impressive and even serious presentations, in as much as I mean, there wasn't a weak member on any team, both had a good performance. I mean, you worked well as a team. Although, it was incredibly depressing, distrustful, miserable, petty by the vision of the world that you put forward. But you put it forward very well. And I think that, you know, this whole idea about, you know, this site, sticking with the science, sticking with the title as it was given to you, you broadened it out to the social, which I think is acceptable and necessary in this discussion. And I think that was kind of quite fine. And I think you really kind of played the polemical discussion, kind of an emotional response to this issue, rather than having any knowledge about it. So there was a backhanded compliment there, but I actually thought it was actually very well handled. The only kind of counter to that is I think that some of the kind of your personal prejudices kind of crept in there without any kind of backup to help you out from on the GM and chicken burgers. But apart from that, it's very, very impressive.
Okay, back to Nicholas.
Yes, I'm inclined to agree that there were few letters of opinion, possibly, on Katie Louise's side that didn't quite get properly worked through. Mistrust of scientists, for instance, possibly justified, but we didn't quite get it was backed up. We felt there were certain assertions being made about humanity and so on. But I thought you were, both of you, incredibly cracking and engaged, and Katie, I thought, answered some questions with great care and thinking on feet, and generally both of you, I was very impressed, and altogether well done.
Just a moment. I've made a mistake, haven't I? I've not sent the individual judges out to individually judge. Okay, just very steal yourself, individual judges. Sorry.
I thought Katie was mildly idealistic, actually, in the end, about how the world might go. And you thought it was rather in some ways, it was slightly over-optimistic about what actually might be achievable in the world, and how we might all, for instance, nobody would go into science unless they wanted to change the world for the better, and that they wouldn't go if they were interested in advisement. I'm not sure. and the boys.
We'll come to the boys now. So if the individual judges would like to leave the room, please. Sorry, that was your friend of mine just saying. We'll call you back in. Okay. Thank you, Graham. Yeah, everyone left? We've got more? Yeah, thanks. Sorry, I'm so sorry to interrupt. Okay, so actually now I'm going to start this time. Well, in fact, Nick, carry on. So you can now talk about the
boys. I thought both of you were very impressive. I thought James had a fantastic way of delivering the arguments with an absolute kind of conviction and a delivery that went right to the audience. So you felt as though they were really going to have to listen to every point, and you were absolutely sure what they were saying was right, and that you were going to. Wrestle with every point that they could throw back at you. There was a great deal of confidence there. Chris, too, and I think standing at this opportunity when you could was probably a good idea because you had a kind of presence, both of you. Chris was very engaging too. You worked well as a team. You brought in new things, very good responses. Now, there were one or two definitely good answers to things that were raised. Not everything got answered, but it's impossible. Too many good questions from the audience.
Yeah.
Very strong, both of you.
I didn't get the impression necessarily that you were working as a team, but I did get an impression that you both knew your subject very well, and there wasn't that sense of tag teaming that you often do. I really find it a very powerful argument when we use examples, and the aspirin one is very good. And the choice when a patient is dying, what do you do? Do you introduce something that may not be fully tested? In fact, that is the situation you face with, because it's all you have. And of course, the important thing is that knowledge continues. And I thought you made that very, very balanced. Throughout most of it, I actually felt you were arguing for a modified version of the precaution.
Thank you, Jack. Austin?
I agree with that. Obviously, you stuck with the science, which personally, and I think you did very well, and as you say, lots of examples and lots of thinking have come back on all sorts of questions. However, I did think that you, by sticking to the science, you missed a trick, which the other side fed you, and you weren't very good at playing with it. You were a bit, speaking of bullshit, a bit rhetorical in your answers. It didn't seem to be full stop. Do you know what I mean? It didn't seem to be answering in the way that you would normally expect a question to be answered, like with an answer. You were sort of doing this kind of flourish, as if to say it's obvious, when it perhaps it wasn't, because somebody was asking you a question. But I think there are good examples. I think you have better scientific knowledge on the other side. I think you engage with some of those discussions at a much higher level. The only problem for me was this point about unforeseeable risks, and you were accepted that you were just a less extreme form of precautionary principle. Now, goodness only knows what that is, because you just made it up, right? But ultimately, when the whole historical discussion came in, when you were saying 100 years ago the car might not have been invented because it's been a big rise to all sorts, right? You set up the historical specific argument about now, right? So therefore, what's the answer to the car now? And actually, you then said, well, actually, we know the car does harm the environment, therefore, maybe we should, do X, Y, and Z to modify that harm, which is the precautionary principle. Right? So the problem there is, I think, you sort of lost a little bit away, I think, primarily by sticking to the science and then got thrown into the social, which maybe you weren't expecting to do, that you kind of lost a little bit of ground there. But, ultimately, apart from Chris's genes, I think it was a technique of the there. I think that it was a very, very impressive performance.
Okay, thank you very much to the judges for their frankness of whatever form that was, fashion tips from Austin. Can we thank our judges?